My name is Dwayne DeFault, and welcome to Selling SaaS, a podcast that's built to get you the best advice from the top experts for go-to-market strategies, sales, and product-led growth. Now let's get into today's episode. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Selling SaaS podcast. And today we actually have a fellow podcaster who also wrote a book that you guys should really get into and read. And I'll let him do the introduction on that. But please help me welcome Mr. Ton Doba.
Thank you.
So why don't you kind of help the audience understand a little bit about your background and kind of where you came up through working with B2B SaaS companies and what led to you writing a book? Because not everyone writes a book, and it's hard to get a book that is, you know, a seller that you get a lot of value from. And the things that you list off in your book, I mean, there's some pretty good hard-hitting things in there that founders should really take to heart. So I'd love to learn like what some of your background was and what led up to that.
Well, I mean, first, when I started in the software industry, it was actually in the 90s. So, I mean, you see a little bit of gray hair here. And I've actually worked all my life at a company in the enterprise software space, a company called Unit 4, which when I started there, it was about 100 people. And then it IPO'd and then acquired an international company. And my roles changed from being just in the Netherlands to being internationally responsible for both product marketing and product strategy. And that evolved, company grew, and then at some point delisted, became part of private equity, and I started to do a couple of other things. In the final part, I became chief evangelist in the company, and then I left, and then I decided I want to do something with all the knowledge and experience that I've gained over time, where I can help those software companies that have a really, really valuable solution to get rewarded for that. And to kind of get the traction that they're often, that's often so hard to get. Because I've been working for a software company and sometimes you just pull your hair out. You know, the solution is like spot on. It is sort of the best thing since sliced bread. And you keep losing against the same options. I mean, we were competing against SAP, Oracle, Microsoft, you know, and the number of companies that go safe, I mean, good for them. But very often, but already at that point that they're making the wrong decisions, a very costly decision. So that's what I wanted to do. Didn't want to work for another large company anymore. And I started my own solo entrepreneurship. And then suddenly you realize that you don't have 4,000 people behind you anymore that fill you in, you know? And you don't have that name behind you anymore that opened doors. So I was like, okay, I need to do a couple of things here. I need to do research about what's going on in the industry to stay fresh. And that's where I realized already, again, it'd been in 2 or 3 months after I started, I need to do, let's start doing a podcast. And that's how it started begin 2018. First of all, as sort of a joke or just an experiment. But I started to really, really like it. And I started to interview tech entrepreneurs. A podcast is called Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission. And if typically those entrepreneurs that inspired me were the ones whereby that are really focused on, first of all, they are on a mission, create meaningful change in the marketplace, but actually do something with biotechnology and people blend in such a way that they're able to do things they've never been able to do before. That inspires me as, you know, being also sort of a product geek. And then, like, long story short there, after about 60, 70 episodes, one of my podcast guests came to me and said, there's a lot of value in here, in those stories and the anecdotes that you get from the guest. You need to write a book about it. And I mean, people that know me must have laughed because I realized also that I was never reading books, let alone writing one. So, but I took it to heart and I was like, yeah, well, maybe this is something that I need to do, you know, and also do football to get my thinking in a row about the things that I've learned over time and the things that I've gathered from the people on the podcast. And that became my thing in 2019. So I started writing a book and that published in 2020.
Wow. I've always wondered, like, what prompts people to write a book instead of a different format? And then, like, what's the process of figuring out what's actually going to be in the book, right? Because I was a big fan of John C. Maxwell, a lot of other different writers and stuff. And I remember him taking a group of people through the process of writing a book and how he put the chapters together. But even then, I'm like, that is so much information to not put in a book. So how did you figure out what those 10 points were? Where the, was there 20 that you had to like cut out in order to focus on those ones? Like, how did you land on the list that's in there?
Well, first of all, I took the advice from someone that actually wrote a book himself.
Good. That's a good place to start.
Yeah, exactly. To get a coach. And so I worked with my coach, Sophie. And that's how things, you know, she guided me on that journey to get things going. And I must say, the framework, well, having the framework at the beginning was really, really helpful. But it was also maybe, I mean, currently writing my second book, and that takes a longer time. Because my first book, I already had been blogging for a good 2 years. About 1.5 years. And I had my podcast that has been 60, 70 episodes already in. So I had all the transcripts, all the anecdotes from all of that. Then, of course, you got your own experience. And I mean, the story at the end unfolded was, okay, what does it need to, what does the book need to be about? And I was like I said, I mean, the people on my podcast, they need to inspire me as well, topic wise. And I've always been a big fan of Seth Godin, and I've been in a number of his courses, LTMBA and the marketing seminar and so on. And one of the things that he sort of popularized was the work Remarkable. I mean, remarkable, the word in itself is like, it's worth making a remark about. And I mean, that is such a simple concept. So my thinking was, what are those software companies that we get excited about, that get traction in the market because people talk about them and that grow from there? And most importantly, what are they doing different when they start to do that, but also what do they keep doing differently in order to keep there? Because I've seen companies that go up and then boom, down again, and then they lose it because of all kinds of problems that arise.
It always makes me think of the phrase, or it's that mindset of, it's one thing to get to the top, but to continue to stay at the top. It's not like you continue doing the same thing that got you there the first time. You have to constantly be renewing and innovating and continuing to execute at a higher level. It's like, you know, sports and championships. You can't just automatically come back and get into the playoffs. You have to play through a whole season in order to do that. And if you don't practice and play at a higher level that you did in the year prior, then you're not going to be anywhere close to it. So I feel from a sports perspective and working with other startups that have succeeded, at least from my definition of success, it's almost like the more success you have, the more work it takes to continue having success at that level. And I feel like that's a really big misconception in business and in life, to where there's that burden of success that people don't realize. And I'd love to hear your perspective and some of the research you've done, companies you've worked with, on what some of those factors are. Like, what are some of those fundamental foundational actions or focuses that these founders or these companies have that enable them to continue having that high level of success?
Well, let me break it down into a couple of points. First of all, I've in my book, literally, I've taken the point to connect business with sports. Because if you read my book, it's actually a story inside a story. I'm living in Spain, in a town called Xabia. And at one point, I'm a surf fan, surf geek as well. I went to a place called Nazaré in Portugal. And in Nazaré, they have these enormous waves, you know, 80 feet, 90 feet waves at some point in the year. So I went for an event over there and I was fascinated by it. And that also, that became an anecdote when I was talking with my coach. She said, do you have a passion that you can bring into the storyline whereby you can make the connections and make it more visceral? That became the storyline. So actually, I'm on a journey going from here, from Xabia to Valencia, to the train to Barcelona, and then a plane to Porto. And in the plane, I meet the CEO of a software company from Porto, and we start talking. That's how it unfolds. So that is an interesting thing in itself. And the reason why I took surfing and big wave surfing as the theme, as the storyline behind the story, because there's so many things to connect with, you know? Those big wave surfers, first of all, you know, to get there, it's about they decide to go for those big waves, not for the smaller waves. So it's market decisions. Then it's like, okay, in the game, how do you position yourself? There's an element of timing. There's an element, of course, about how fit you are. It's the conditions of the day, which are the conditions of the market. Is the economy up or down? Is there a political issue? I mean, all of these things, entrepreneurs always have to deal with that because those things change market dynamics. And as a consequence, sometimes, you know, you're flying and you grow fast, but this one thing that happens in the market brings it down again. So that's exactly how I brought these storylines into the book. But talking about the 10 traits that I define, the 10 traits that define remarkable software businesses, I've put it into three parts, three levers, I call them in my book, the value lever, the viability lever, and the volume lever. And then the value lever is like your foundation. That if you start well there, the others will go better, easier, less costly, will become less costly. So let's go through the 10. The value lever is about 10, three traits. First one, remarkable software companies acknowledge and realize that they cannot please everyone. So it's about niching down. The second one is they create something valuable and desirable. And these two things together is a very important thing, because you can solve a valuable problem, but if you create something that's not desirable, you know, demand will stay out.
Can you give an example like of the difference, or maybe a situation that people may be familiar with? I ask that because I have this conversation with founders and product leaders all the time, to where I call it, to simplify it, it's that feature that they build that looks good on a marketing campaign, but then there's the feature that they build that keeps their ideal customers from churning, that may not look good on a billboard. And they're two completely different things. And the challenge that I always put in front of marketing teams is, how do they message and position that non-shiny feature that doesn't look desirable, but it's highly valuable? Like, how do you bridge that gap?
Oh, in my book, I'm talking about a triangle. When I was on podcast with Jonathan Stark, he actually started to refer to it as the broken triangle, which is an interesting thing in itself. But it's about three questions that you should ask. The moment you talk to a customer, you decide for a particular market. You first of all, start to look at, okay, what are all the problems that keep them up at night? So that can be a list of 20, 30, 40 different issues. But you then do, you put this into a spreadsheet almost, and you start answering three questions. On a scale of 1 to 10, how valuable is this to solve for your customer? And the second question is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how urgent or critical is it for your customer to solve it? And then the third thing is, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your ability to exceed expectations on this? And you already see there, is the moment you bring them together, valuable multiplied by urgency or criticality multiplied by your ability to exceed expectations, it becomes a formula. And you want to focus on the ones that have a number that is more than 500, between 500 and 1,000, ideally the highest one. It's in that triangle again where valuable and desirable happens. Because you can solve something that's highly valuable and not critical, and that is a nice to have. So it's like, yeah, but maybe next month, not priority. You want to have something that is both valuable and critical or urgent, because that is something that's high on the agenda. But that doesn't make it desirable again. You know, that makes it just something that is, okay, it's a priority. And that's where your ability to exceed expectations comes in. What can you do whereby you create something that, for them, your solution versus the alternative, whatever the alternative is, that can be your competitor, that can be what they do today themselves, that creates a shift in value, whereby they say, you know, once they see it, it's like, you know, they can't unsee how not to do it anymore. Or how they could possibly, continue working without that. And that is at the end, you know, kind of when people are talking about when you realize you have product market fit, is when people start screaming when you take your product away from them. But you can actually orchestrate for that following those three very simple questions. And that's how you position around it.
Then I love that, because I feel like there's this, I don't want to say awakening or realization in tech. It's almost like a modern renaissance between the difference of privileged pieces of software, this tech to tech selling circle that we've been in the last 3 to 5 years, where you have entire industries, entire markets dependent on its ability to integrate with this one tool. Like, we can use the Salesforce marketplace. There are hundreds of apps that their only job is to make one thing easier inside of that tool. But if that customer stops using Salesforce, then they're, you know, up a creek without a paddle. And I've found that the closer you are to the customer's ideal business process, the more valuable and critical it is. That's why, like, when I work with companies as a coach or a consultant, that's one of the things I look for is how close is their software to the customer? Is it something they have to use and log into every day? Is it just a once a month login admin type thing? I find that that triangle is very easy to figure out when you're closest to the customer. If you are second or third degree removed, it gets very speculative, like the middleware type companies, like a Zapier type thing, where you're that connector of programs, like you're valuable, but people don't know you're valuable. It's like, it gets really, really challenging to establish that product market fit that we're talking about. And interestingly enough, kind of segue right into the other part of the conversation that I'm fascinated about is the difference between like startups and scale-ups and what companies struggle to do once they find their version of product market fit. So that's kind of a two-part question, but let's say they go through that broken triangle, right? Those three questions to ask inside of that value bullet point, right? Like inside of that, and they get product market fit, like what is the difference between a startup that has product market fit and then that scale up? And I ask that because in the intro of your podcast, you give off some pretty hefty statistics around 90% of startups fail. It was like 70% or 72% of scale. And they fail. And so that was a stat I didn't realize. And that's pretty alarming because you would think that once they establish product market fit and they have some traction, then it's keeping the wheels turning and keeping the train on the tracks rather than it going to fail. And so I'd be interested to hear, you know, in your experience, like what is the big difference between those two situations, a startup and a scale up?
Startup at the end is still this, they're very much still on a journey to find that product market fit. It's a lot of experimentation. And of course, things, they get customers, but it's not that it's repetitive. The repetitiveness isn't there really yet. So, I mean, if they go, for example, for funding, it's more selling the vision and about where this can go rather than say, okay, if we get 5 million and we throw it on that and that, it turns into 50 million, you know? Whereas a scale-up, they figured it all out, you know? There's repetition and they've tuned and tuned and tuned. And for those companies, if they go in for the right reasons to get funding, they start from a position of strength. Because they know what's working and they have an option. Okay, either we can keep bootstrapping the company and grow it with customers funding it, or we bring in external funding and we know exactly what to throw it on, what fires need to become big fires and how they will work.
And you're no longer building these growth spreadsheets based on speculative information. And that's very dangerous to be in when you're still in that startup phase, because what I've seen is you have that growth spreadsheet you get from your VC or some coach that you hired, and they're like, here's some benchmarks to go after. It's really hard as a founder to not lean very heavily on those numbers without understanding that those are just some guardrails to use when it comes to those examples, and you have to figure out what works for your company. And so like, what have you seen that causes those scale ups? So they get that product market fit, they start to have that repetition. So what causes those 70 some odd percent to fail?
Complacency.
Really?
A big portion of that I've had Radhika Dutta also on my podcast, and she's talking about it in different ways with her book Radical Product Think. There's all kind of diseases popping up. There's egos get into way, and there's these stories of the people that say, you know, we've grown 5x, 6x, 7x last year. You know, we are unbeatable. We are on this until, you know, and they get, how do you say that? They get greedy. They start taking shortcuts. There's maybe a little bit of overselling to VCs, whereby the target that they have, well, the valuation that they have opted for requires them to keep growing at a certain X number. And then there's this quarter where it doesn't work that way. Yeah. And another quarter. And this, yeah, they, that is, I've had a couple of people on my podcast that have been doing really, really well. And one mistake, I was talking, for example, to Equalture. These are two sisters that are running a very successful company in the HR tech space and recruitment to help the world get rid of the bias in hiring. And when they got money in, they thought, okay, now we have to prove to the world we can sell to everybody. And technically, you know, everybody that hires people can use their solution. But that didn't work at all for them. And after about a year or so, they got behind the table and said, you know, something is not right here. We are attracting those customers that are buying or subscribing to the solution for the wrong reasons, that we can never make a fan. In my work, I'm talking very often with regards to, for example, that first trait, acknowledging that you cannot please everybody. If you take 100 companies with exactly the same demographics, you know, the same firmographics, the same size, the same revenue, the same number of people, the same where what they do, where they operate, there's going to be this, you can equally say 50% will never buy from you, 50% will buy from you, you know, all day long. What is the difference there? That has nothing to do with demographics. That has to do with the people that work there, their worldviews, what they care about, what they value, what they aspire. And that's, you realize that when you're into a sales process and you're within 10 minutes, you are speaking the same language, you're on the same wavelength, or the opposite around. But we think, okay, they want an HR solution, they want a recruitment solution, and we have one. I mean, I had the same thing at Unit 4 at some point in time. Having discussions with sales, I go, why are you after this prospect? Well, they want a GL, and we have one. Well, but why would they buy from us? You know, just the fact that we can cover 95% of the feature that they want doesn't make they're going to buy from us. So that's where niching down comes in place. And yeah, having something, because if you typically also look at the horizontal space where there's a lot of competition, functionality-wise, table stake-wise, they do exactly the same. Like, what is your edge? That is where it comes back to. Are you solving a problem that's highly valuable and highly critical? But the third question, what are you doing to help them or to exceed expectations in this? And that needs to be your thing.
So what do you mean by exceed expectations? Because I have my own like definition of it, and I really like to dig in and connect with the buyer and niche down. Like, I always, when I'm working with founders, I am adamantly trying to fine-tune channel acquisition, like what's producing. Even if a channel, let's say you got five different channels that you're marketing towards, it could be paid, organic, referrals, whatever. I'm always looking at what's our most efficient channel and what's our least efficient channel. And even if they're converting, you know, quote unquote, well, but that channel is producing non-good fit customers, low value leads or whatever, I'm always trying to get rid of that, because focusing more on the vertical continues to fine tune the messaging. It enhances your sales team's effectiveness. But back to the original question of exceed expectations. Is that, in your definition, during the sales process? Is it during customer success? Is it underselling the way you describe the product on the marketing website and then having cool stuff on the inside? Like, what do you mean by exceed expectations?
All of the above.
Yeah.
No, but it's like that. And it's very often, it has nothing to do with features. It has more to do with design principles, the DNA of the product. I mean, I was 2 weeks ago, I was in Germany on stage explaining to employees of one of my customers, from my perspective, how their solution was radically different from all the leaders out there in the marketplace. And this is a company called Topdesk, and they compete with the likes of ServiceNow and some other vendors. And I mean, from the outset, I can now see, okay, this is a company that is perfectly made for ServiceNow. And this is a company that was made and has got to be a raving fan, for example, with Topdesk. And it had to do with the functionality scope of these solutions. Both have been around for a long time. Everything is in there that you could possibly wish for. Where they make the difference is, what has gone in terms of the thinking, in terms of the outcomes that they are pushing for and how they bring that across. So for example, if I go back to the Unit 4 time, technically on a feature function level, we were head-to-head with Oracle Financials and dynamics, the dynamic suites on financials and payroll and all of these type of things. 98%, 97% tick all the boxes. But that's not how we sold it. Our solution was fundamentally different in terms of how it was conceptualized. And that is like the DNA. I'm with my customers, I'm always trying to figure out what are your three magic concepts. And ours was based on a very flexible information model, which, you know, there's a technicality. But when you're in a business, when you're in the service business, for example, local authorities, universities, professional service type companies, where there's a lot of change going on, business change, process change, regulatory change, just name it. There were five different type of categories. Our customers could deal with that without even realizing it. We had customers that were deploying the solution across 30 countries, had 8,000 people on the solution, consultants and so on, and they managed the whole solution technically with a team of three people in total, 1.5 FTE. And I was once speaking to a CIO that came from a site that was running SAP, and he said, this was a smaller company, and I had a team of 15 people. And that is like a cost aspect. But typically where the difference comes and where you exceed expectations is then, it's not about the fact that they are spending less money on how many people are managing the whole thing, but what it was doing for the business. They could make changes on the fly. They were not going dark when there was a change happening. Where other solutions, the company went dark. Customers started to see it. Product delays were often the case. All to the point where the stock price went down after a number of serious hits where the ERP was not keeping up with the business. And that once you are able to showcase that in a demo and so on, it's like, okay, now I get it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Selling SaaS Podcast. And if you got value from today, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.